I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver, British Columbia at thecommentary.ca. Nick Thran joins me now. The poet has just published a new collection of poetry, his fourth, Existing Music. I'll ask him about the poems in the book that look at memory, music, and how music affects the memories that we hold, good or bad, painful or happy. He's a talented writer who evokes melancholy and longing, just as well as he deploys a love of language and whimsy as he uses words as he intends, painting images or summoning in the reader certain sounds as one reads. He takes us to the world of a bookstore, something he knows well as he makes his living as a bookseller as well as a writer and editor. Nick Thran's previous books include the mixed genre collection If It Gets Quiet Later On, I Will Make a Display, and three previous poetry collections. Earworm won the 2012 Trillium Book Award for Poetry. This new book is published by Nightwood Editions. Nick will be a part of an event this Thursday, the 8th of May, at Iron Dog Books. It's a double launch of this book, as well as Tom Wayman's Out of the Ordinary. The event is free, and doors open at 6:30. You can register at irondogbooks.com. We taped this interview 2.5 weeks ago with Nick joining me from Fredericton, New Brunswick. Please welcome to the Plant Online program, Nick Thran. Mr. Thran, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us. I guess it's good afternoon where you are.
It is, yes, mid-afternoon, but happy to be here, morning, afternoon, wherever we are.
How did you end up in Fredericton?
My wife, Sue Sinclair, is also a poet, and she got a job at the University of New Brunswick. She teaches in the English department, teaches creative writing, and so we were both applying for jobs furiously, and she landed the job, and so we went out here. But we were here in 2012 for about a year. She was writer-in-residence for a year, and so we knew, we both knew where we were going and what we were getting into, and it was a place that was going to be good for us.
In preparing for this interview, I must have read somewhere that you do have a background out here on the West Coast, is that right?
I do, yes. I was born in Prince George, and my father worked for PG Pulp and Paper, and he kept moving around various locations in British Columbia. So I lived in Surrey for a while, I lived in Prince Rupert for a while, I went to school on Vancouver Island, both in high school and in my undergrad. And, yeah, we lived in a few different provinces, a few different places in the States and overseas as well. So I was used to traveling around. So.
And I guess,
I've been settled here for about 8 years, and that's the longest I've been living anywhere.
Yeah, and I guess a constant throughout all your life, whether, you know, you're a young person or now as an adult, you carry around all these memories. You know, there are a couple of poems in the collection that talk about places that you've lived, say, in your youth. A lot of those memories are tied into music, aren't they?
They are. Well, I mean, I'm always looking for, you know, some kind of firm ground to stand on. Right? It's a wonderful experience moving around like that in a lot of ways. It makes you very adaptable person, and you meet a lot of interesting people, of course. But in that idea of what home is, certainly music became one of those places. Reading, bookstores, that kind of thing. So definitely music is a place that I've always, and maybe that's part of what some of the sort of the simpler, wistful kind of three chord songs that are kind of lyric heavy, maybe there's a kind of just kind of base level sense of home, or a kind of immediate kind of access to that kind of music that's always been somewhat comforting to me.
Well, when you hear music for the first time, are you listening to the music itself or the lyrics?
I think I'm listening to the music first, but then I'm absolutely delighted when I encounter a lyric. I mean, I was just listening actually this morning for a little bit to a Fred Eaglesmith song, a country guy, and he said something like, something about being so lonely. I'm not paraphrasing this correctly, but it was about being sort of so alone that he makes Hank Williams seem like a party of five. And kind of, I jumped in the kitchen a little bit, and I was like, oh, that's delightful. So, I mean, I listen to a lot of different kinds of music, but of course, being a poet. I do pay special attention to the lyrics and the kind of space, not just the lyrics themselves and the interesting kind of images or things that they come up with there, but also I think the way that those lyrics situate themselves within the music, maybe aren't exactly at the fore, but kind of, yeah, situate themselves in the environment that the other instruments kind of create. So
I was just thinking about, I posed that question to you. It's usually the music that's the gateway, you know, that's the sound that gets our attention.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, especially with popular music nowadays, and you walk into a store and you hear it, that's what you hear first, is the music. And then if you hear it long enough times, say, you know, especially with popular music that they play all the time, you know, things that hit the top 10, then you start listening to the lyric. And then that takes on a new experience altogether. And you know, I've interviewed composers over the years. You know, people have written for Broadway. And I've always been interested in what comes first, either the music or the lyric. And, you know, they all have, you know, it depends on what kind of show they're writing for, you know, because it's usually one or the other, and it's not usually the same even with the same composer, right? But, it, you know, I've read a lot of Sondheim's lyrics over the years, and he published two collections of his lyrics.
Yeah, I remember seeing that.
Yeah, and the craftsmanship, if you will, of how he puts that together, and then you go back and then you take the CD or you download the thing on your phone to listen to it. They're two different things, but when they're put together, it's something altogether new, if you will.
Yeah, it is, and I mean, I envy musicians that. That's something I don't have a particular sort of experience with, and I do look at, I mean, there are musicians out there, one of them, David Berman, well, he's no longer with us, but he's somebody that I write about a little bit in the book, and he has a book of poetry called Actual Air that is just wonderful, and he's also a brilliant lyricist. But there's definitely a difference. I mean, I've listened to the music enough and read that book enough to know that they are sort of different kinds of environments. And I'm very much interested as a poet in the music of language. And I have the luxury, I guess, maybe of not thinking about how I'm going to put a drum beat over this. Or maybe I don't know if it's a luxury or a sparseness. I mean, that's an interesting question, I think, in and of itself. But I admire that. Also, I mean, anything in which you sort of collaborate with other musicians, or even if you're layering something that's, you know, it's not written, it's an instrument, you're layering other voices, that kind of thing, it's always amazing to me. Like, I always think of that in terms of film, too. Like, when you see a filmmaker who has clearly put their artistic vision all the way through to the end, you just think of all the various layers and contributions and discussions with others and different performances. It's incredible to me that something can get finished in that way. And part of what I love about poetry is I don't have that. You know, I don't have to incorporate a lot of that, but I also get to think about very closely about what it's like to be influenced by something else and someone else, and to see, you know, push a poem up against the edge of, you know, another person's artwork or something. I've been thinking about it's almost like a miniature kind of version of that, and I really like that about the act of writing poetry itself.
I wrote this down, and I didn't think it was appropriate, so I didn't think I was going to use this question. Does playing music afford the musician a different or closer understanding of the music itself? And I want to take that idea and just adapt it a little bit. As a writer of poetry, do you because you're coming out to Vancouver shortly to launch the book, and I suspect you're going to read something from the book.
Yes.
A couple of things probably from the book.
I will read everything I read will be from the book.
Yeah, as you're writing, do you read things out loud and do you think about that part, or are you just focusing on what's written and what's on the page, say?
I used to read a lot more out loud to myself, but I've worked for quite a while now, both as a writer and as an editor, and I've spent a lot of time with the mechanics of people's lines and particular words and things like that. So that voice is mostly internal now. You know, I can read it out to myself.
Yeah.
But it is different when you get out there and read it in front of other people. And I think it's exciting. I mean, there is a performative element to it, even though I think I read in a fairly plain spoken way. There's definitely that moment before you read it where you have to say, okay, let's just slow it down and let the words do the work. But I work kind of diligently enough on the small parts of the lines. I probably overthink and overwork poems to a certain degree, but to get that kind of sonic quality to them while it's hopefully trying to still be kind of plain spoken. I mean, there's a poem in the book called Hermetic Fabric that kind of talks a little bit, it speculates about the silence of a kind of imaginary musician who's kind of a composite of different musicians I was thinking about at the time, about what it might mean to just kind of go silent for an extended period of time between records. And I liked the basic form of that poem musically because I thought, okay, I can really be kind of adventurous and come up with all these kind of hypothetical scenarios, and the poem can potentially go on a little bit longer than some of my other poems. But then when you get down to the actual mechanics of the music, it's like something between the end of the poem says, you know, something sort of trendy to look up, and the question of whether I say look up or I say like Google, you know, in the original draft, and what the sound of Google or look up means, and what it means to sort of use that particular word that's associated with a company that maybe I you know, maybe hope isn't around forever and that kind of thing, and going through that kind of process. And then also at the end of that poem, I had a different title. And I thought there's a project, a hypothetical project that a musician has called the Abandoned Cannery Project. Mm. And I thought, okay, is that the title of this poem? And then I thought, well, what's a Nordic, you know, I wonder what abandoned cannery is in like Norwegian or Finnish. I can't even remember what exactly the language. So I went into the translator there, and it was something like hermetic fabrica or something like that, you know. And so I then sussed English out of that. And when I'm in that place, it feels like making music, and I'm terribly excited about that. You know, I feel like kind of in the folds of something musical and larger, and that might be layered kind of like a song, you know, if that makes sense. Yeah.
There's a line in that poem. I flipped to it as you mentioned the title, because I tend to forget these things, but there's a line in there that I've been remembering for the last few days since I read it. And a room of goodwill might unlock what was never really present. I can't tell you what that's meant to me in terms of when I read that, I don't know, it must have been a week and a half ago or two when I started the collection. I don't know, I've been thinking about that in places and especially people. I don't know, there's no question here other than that's a really great line.
Oh, thanks. Well, it's always, you know, it is. It's an interesting just kind of sociological thing, this idea that you know, a musician could have such a sense of community, you know, 'cause she could bring so much, you know, to a group of people. Here I'm not talking about poetry, but I'm talking about, you know, a musician in front of thousands of people or whatever.
Yeah.
And just how, you know, just what it is in the brain that might sort of shut down and cause a person to kind of to turn away from that, or for that to produce a kind of anxiety. I mean, it makes sense in terms of, you know, certain, you know, aspects of performance and the nerves and the expectations and things like that. But it seems like a really fertile ground just to kind of talk about, you know, how we connect with people, how we disconnect with people, just how important connection with other people is. And how that sort of isolation, you know, that feeling of isolation or disconnection can occur in somebody who seems in a lot of ways, you know, hyper connected to people and culture as a touring musician of any sort of popularity might be. I don't know, that's always been an interesting kind of space for me to think about people in general, I guess.
Yeah, we tend to move through life to just get through it, I think. And that might involve faking it sometimes. Mm-hmm. I'm sure, you know, there are performers who you know, go in front of a crowd at night at 8 p.m. and are probably just waiting for it to end and you know, get back to the hotel or get back on the road. And yet, for the people in that room, you know, for first timers, it'll be an experience altogether different than, say, somebody who knows the playlist and who's known the artist for years, and they could have all sorts of experiences in that moment. But for the musician or the star, if you will, it may just be another gig, right?
Yeah. Well, we see that. That kind of story described over and over again in a lot of ways in a lot of different mediums, don't we?
Yeah. Well, what is it like for you to have your poetry, say, interpreted by a reader? I mean, I just read a line of yours and told you what I thought about it. What if I get it wrong? What does that mean to you as the writer, say?
I don't believe that a person really can get it wrong. I mean, if there's a it's one of the great things about poetry in that is that it is kind of it's tough to make generalizations, but one of the things I like about poetry is its capacity to kind of dissociate from the kind of instructional or kind of manipulative, if you think about advertising and things like that, the kinds of language that, well, we're talking about politics before we started recording here, you know, and it can kind of make a space to the side of those kinds of languages and kind of listen to what's going on in those kind of corners there. So, I mean, I think about certain lines that first attracted me to poetry. There's a second book of an American poet. I never really got too into their body of work after, but their first couple of books, this guy William Matthews, a book called Sleep for the Long Flight, he's an American poet, and there was just this line that was like, we lie down among the sandwiches, the world is strange, look into our eyes and see. And I mean, I've thought about that line and looked at it, and it makes no sense, but it is a kind of guide, it's a kind of guiding line to me in a way, because it means that, you know, I can write down that kind of line, and it can have an effect on a reader. Maybe, you know, that kind of particular one, and it can kind of sing or resonate in a particular kind of way, particular to that kind of poem. That is, I don't know what it is, but it keeps me coming back, trying to find out what that is, and to try and write that kind of line. And what's been really interesting about this book is this is my fourth collection of poems. I had a mixed genre collection a couple of years ago that had a couple poems in it, but is to see just how much the poem is not just my own. I take that up thematically in some parts of the book, but also just in terms of thinking about, like, there's a line at the end of the Pastorale poem, that one about California. And in the last line, it has something to do with, you know, it felt so good to be sure that I never forgave her. And after the book was in the process of publication, it was, I noticed an echo of that line with a line from poet Luke Hathaway, just released an older book called Years, Months, and Days, I think it's called. And there was a line in there called, that just said something like, you know, oh, please wake me from the sleep of being sure. So it's not the same line, but it's not even the kind of same sentiment. But I could see how that line was somewhere in my mind when I was writing that poem. And that used to be a little bit anxiety producing, but now, having written for a while, I'm very excited by that idea. A line in there too, something of like four instruments and a live trout is five instruments, another one of these kind of sandwich lines. And I was so sure that I didn't write that line. I wrote an email to six of my sort of more surreal poetry writing friends and said, "Is this your line?" Because I'd been carrying it around for years. But I don't know if I wrote this, and I still, even to the editor, I said, if you see this line in a long John Ashbery poem, you know, at some point, I apologize. Yeah. I've tried to do the homework. I've tried to see if this line, I've put it in the internet and this kind of thing, but it might be my line. Yeah. I hope it is, but again, certainty, I'm not sure.
Yeah, I laughed when you said that line, because I remember reading that in the book and just delighting in the imagery of it all. There's a joke that I know I heard somewhere, but I can't find out where I heard it, and it was referring to, say, the length of one's career on television, and the line I think that I read was that he had a career on television just as long as Jack Ruby, and I've tried to find that, and because I've used it, I use it on Twitter or whatever social media I'm posting on that day, and I can't find it for the life of me. So I don't know who said it.
Yeah.
Someone said, "Well, you said it."
that's great. Yeah. I mean, it's interesting.
We
struggle so much to differentiate ourselves and things like that, but it's a really intricate web, and I think the longer a person lives a creative life, one of the sustaining things is just to see how intricate that is, and just how exciting it is to sort of, be a part of it. Like, I like the idea, like I'm thinking about that Luke Hathaway line, of extending, a certain feeling in his line there, in my own, again, thinking about that with musicians and things like that, and not just sort of covers, but I listen to a lot of sort of podcasts. Like, I love that song Exploder podcast where they describe musicians kind of break down their songs, I remember, I think it was Fleetwood Mac, the drummer, saying, "Oh, I liked this riff, that the Stones had on this particular song. So I took it and I added this small hitch to it, and I can't remember what the song they were breaking down was." And so they played the track from the Stones, and then they played the Fleetwood Mac, that isolated the two drum tracks. Mm. And it was just, it wasn't a theft. Like, there was a variation on there, but it was like, I wanted to carry the feeling of this. And I knew enough to know that I had to do this to make it mine. Yeah. Put in the context of the song, and that there were these other elements to the song that we were putting together that would make it kind of different. I don't know. I find that kind of conversation exciting as well.
I mentioned to you that I wanted to talk about translation, because there are a couple poems in this collection that deal with translation. I've always thought that when I have an author of a novelist on, especially if they've written the original work in another language, and it's usually French when these authors come on this podcast because they're Canadian, they're nominated for a big prize, say, and English is not their first language, and so it's obviously translated. And I've always thought it's important to ask about that collaboration between the author and the translator, because I'm reading the book in English, and obviously I'm reading a lot of work that a translator's put in, right?
Yeah. Well, my experience with translation is a little bit different in terms of this book. I was reading an old anthology called Roots and Wings of Spanish poetry. It was published in the 70s for an American audience. And so there were English and Spanish translations there. And I'd lived in Spain for a little while. I'm not fluent in Spanish by any stretch. So I was reading the Spanish and the English side by side. And I was looking at this poet, Jose Hierro. He's passed away. He came to prominence in I believe like the 30s or 40s there, just kind of out of the Spanish Civil War, that kind of generation, kind of right after. He was in prison for a little while as a youth. I was looking at this translation, this English translation, and I knew enough Spanish reading it to go, this is not, the music from this is not here in this English version. And so I started kind of pruning words, changing words, looking back and forth at the Spanish, and I arrived at this translation that I thought, okay, this, to my ear, sounds like the Spanish sounds. So every once in a while I would just do these kind of translations. I'd look for sort of multiple English translations and things. So it's not true translation, really. So when I was thinking about this book, but I'd been doing these sporadically over a number of years. And then so I was starting to think just in the context of music, you know, the way certain songs kind of build off a certain, a particular kind of refrain or chorus or even lyric, to kind of make a new song. I thought, well, can I do this with some of these hero translations? And so I started kind of experimenting with that, and there's still a certain mysterious element in that. I don't really know if I've really read Jose Hero. You know, I have his books.
Yeah.
But it's a different language. It's a different historical time. But I feel this camaraderie and this companionship with his work. So I wanted to kind of explore that mystery a little bit. And again, taking a certain license that I think that some translators. I was in the Banff Center of the Arts, and I was fortunate enough to be at a residency there where, while the translators were there, they used to have this translators residency. I don't know if they still have it. And they would meet every afternoon, and one person would talk about a particular problem of a particular translation they were doing. There'd be like 12 languages at the table. And I remember it was like the translator of the novel, A Little Life, the French translator of that novel. I can't remember her name now, but she was talking about how there's these long run-on sentences throughout that novel, and the main character of that novel is somebody who self-harms, and like there's certain thematic reasons for the way the sentences are. But in the French, everything wanted to be a parenthetical remark. There were all these parentheses, and she just couldn't reconcile. She spent another 2 years on it, too. I mean, they must have been clamoring to get this novel out in France, but it didn't come out till 2018.
Yeah.
And I just, again, you know, talking about kind of poem making, song building, that kind of thing. I'd listen to these people talk about this particular, and I was just there as a tourist. I just said, can I come every afternoon when I take a break from my own writing and just listen to you guys talk about this? And so that kind of gave me permission, I think, to think about certain sort of small elements of a particular image in Hero's work or that kind of thing, and build these poems. And there's only one really at the end of the book where it takes a direct translation that I did, but then I reversed it. I flip the lines around. I describe it in the notes in the back of the book. I blew it out into prose and changed every single word. And it still feels like that poem to me in a lot of ways.
Yeah, see, right? That's the wonderful thing that reminds me of that question I asked earlier. That here you are, you've taken on this new work, if you will, done the homework, to coin a phrase, and you've developed something new to it, and in the process have this deep connection to it that you probably otherwise wouldn't if you've just simply read something cold or once or twice and put it away.
Yeah. And I love that idea, too, of that this person is so... I mean, we have such an opportunity to just know, to put everything about ourselves out there and stuff like that. And I do sometimes wonder if we're sometimes less productively mysterious to each other than maybe we've been in the past. So this sort of connection, you know, it just felt like I had a pen pal.
Yeah.
You know, who I didn't really know, but this pen pal is like a ghost too now. You know, like I don't know if I believe in ghosts, but that's a conversation for another podcast probably.
Indeed.
But I just found, again, that kind of kinship to be similar to the kind of kinship that I feel to like a songwriter that I really admire too, right? Because music isn't autobiography, music isn't an essay, you know, music isn't a biographical film, right? There are different, more mysterious kind of elements at play, but I think, you know, that the instruments bring, and language is one of those instruments, right? So that's part of what I was thinking about with this book.
Nick, it's so great talking to you today. I could talk all day with you. Just have to save this for another time. Congratulations on this collection and continued good luck. I appreciate your time and safe travels.
This has been great, Joe. Thank you for having me.
The book is called Existing Music. It's published by Knightwood Editions. Its author, Nick Thren, joined me on the line from Fredericton in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plunton.